two state claims concerning the inspection the appellees carried out at the nursing home that Golden Years operates.
Well, it wasn't really sua sponte, counsel. The defendants did move for summary judgment substantively on all of the claims here. There wasn't a terribly well-developed argument on the state law claims. That's very true. And there was a reference to a relinquishment of jurisdiction on 1367 grounds once the federal claims were dismissed, but there was an across-the-board motion for summary judgment on the case in its entirety, including the state law claims. So I think it's an error to characterize this as a sua sponte entry of summary judgment on the state law claims, and certainly your response brief covered the substance of those claims.
I would say two things to that, Your Honor. One, there's different meanings, obviously, of the term sua sponte, and certainly your characterization is correct. It's not that this order came out of the blue and that there was no discussion of summary judgment. And further, as you correctly pointed out, there was, in fact, a motion for summary judgment that expressed itself in terms of all claims, and it did so because it was an argument for collateral estoppel, which made no distinction between federal claims and state claims. That would have, had it applied, and Judge Barker found that it did not.
There was also some language about the claims in their entirety failing to state a claim and that sort of thing. And as I said, none of it was terribly well-developed beyond the collateral estoppel.
I certainly agree with you on the well-developed point, Your Honor, and it was a difficult
deal. They did spend several pages setting forth evidence about the state defendant's bad motives, and I have the same question that my colleague has, because it really made me wonder what kind of additional evidence you would have presented in your summary judgment papers had you known that the state law claims were clearly in place. In other words, what did you hold back here?
Judge Rovner, as I understand your question, there's really two parts of my answer, and I want to make sure I answer them both. One is the fact that the appellees in their motion did address the issue of intent, and certainly that's true. They addressed it in the context of whether there was an intent, a bad motive element, to the two federal claims. We had a due process claim and a Fourth Amendment claim, and there was a legal argument that went back and forth about whether those intent elements actually applied to those claims, which is not on appeal now. However, being cautious as we were, we wanted to address those on the merits, which brings us to the second part of your question is, what did we hold back? Essentially the what if we were given notice? And Your Honor, the answer to that is it lies in the difference between the standards, and the parties talk about that a lot in their brief, and Judge Barker recognized that there was different standards. The standard for our state law claims is not necessarily whether there's a bad motive. It's the question is whether there was a motive that was outside the propriety, that there was any ulterior improper motive.
Well, what's the evidence of that, though? I mean, we've got a lot of obnoxious behavior by inspectors, but, you know, obnoxious behavior doesn't equate with ulterior motive or malice for purposes of the state law claims.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't mean to speak over you. It does in two respects. One is that the state law is clear, and it's undisputed by the parties that this is part of the state law, that lack of probable cause is a basis for.
But this isn't really that same kind of context, though. These are civil enforcement inspections that are, as I understand it, required to occur periodically. This wasn't necessary. I mean, there was a complaint that had been lodged, but this wasn't a complaint-driven investigation for which the investigators are looking for probable cause to issue some sort of charge. It's a routine investigation. They find deficiencies. They report the deficiencies. Those are litigated through the state system. Your client wins on all but one. But that's not the same sort of context that we would say there's a lack of probable cause in the sense that the cases refer to that.
You raise a good point, Your Honor, and we're kind of in the second point today where you have legal terms that have multiple meanings, and certainly the words probable cause do. There is the traditional Fourth Amendment probable cause, a police officer signing an affidavit, but there's also a state law notion of probable cause that's floating here. And it's an element of these claims, the lack of probable cause. And that's distinct and hasn't been limited in Indiana case law, including the cases we've cited, the Kroger case, the Woolworth case, two situations where we're dealing with criminal charges that were made. It's any kind of claim or process that's brought. And in this case, the process we're looking at that was brought without probable cause is these deficiency violations. And the critical evidence that we did not need to address on the federal claims that weren't addressed on the intent element of the federal claims that were addressed, we would have had we known that the specific issue of whether the malice elements of the two state law claims were raised is the 16 of the 17 violations they found against us were found by the ALJ in the state proceedings to have no basis. We didn't have a reason to flesh that out in federal claims, but to show absence of probable cause, we certainly would have. We would have gone through each and every one of those. And I'm not sure Judge Barker would have, under the record we had, appreciated us putting the 400-page administrative record. It was a very lengthy record we had to go through to knock those violations out. But there is some discussion of this in the record. It's not addressed by the district court's opinion in any way. But we know that, for instance, we had one of the violations involved the faulty slamming of the door to the dementia ward, which has to have a certain type of latch, obviously, to keep.
Forgive me. I'm going to go back a bit because I may be missing something, but Judge Barker decided the state law claims on the merits. You know, she determined, in essence, that because she found no evidence of any bad acts for purposes of evaluating the 14th and 4th Amendment claims, there could not have been any bad acts that supported the state law claims. Why does it not end right there?
On two levels, Your Honor. One, the standards are different. As I was mentioning, that we have a lack of state law probable cause that applies to the state law claims that was not analyzed in the context of the federal case, wasn't briefed below, wasn't argued below, that we certainly would have addressed. But second and more importantly, Judge Barker's opinion doesn't address all the evidence that's out there. There's a critical fact we put forth on summary judgment, because we did come forward with evidence of intent to deal with that issue on the federal claims, and that's the fact that the atmosphere was so poisonous and so aggressively hostile to our employees. We had 10 employees quit, and they weren't just employees, they were our nursing staff.
To me, that's a very odd piece of evidence. How do we know that the nurses quit because of the harassment by the inspectors rather than because they felt it necessary to jump ship before it sank? How do we know this?
Your Honor, you ask a really great question, and I would submit that for purposes of fact-finding, of course, we don't know. We're on summary judgment. The burden initially would have been on the appellees to show, of course, that that's not true. But our record does show that. The testimony in the record is that the nurses did quit directly because of the atmosphere, and they were afraid of reprisals from the appellees because of the atmosphere that had developed and because of the animosity that existed. And frankly, I think someone was expressing their willingness to actually leave their professional position is the best evidence that this animosity exceeded what Judge Barker characterizes as mere impoliteness and mere incivility, but went into the kind of personal animosity that Indiana law allows you to establish the state law element on. And the evidence, the site, Your Honor, for that is APA 225. Our director of nursing testified uncontradicted below, uncontradicted here, uncontradicted anywhere in the record, and we are in summary judgment that was the reason why they left. And Your Honor, there is of course other evidence. I want to pull back to the probable cause issue. I think I left unsaid that there is of course evidence that would support what the ALJ did. The Court of Appeals upheld in large extent their findings, and this is resolved now that there was no support for those. And of course, one of the things we didn't get to address when we didn't have an opportunity to address this probable cause element is that unfortunately I'm in a position I can't, because we're in a summary judgment where this wasn't litigated, I can't cite you to the record, but what we would have shown is that pursuant to the federal regulations, when one of these deficiencies is found, we have an opportunity to submit what's an essential response. It sets out our evidence. This was a 400-page document. One of the appellees, who was by federal law required to include that report along with everything else that was submitted to the agency, not only failed to do that, but actually destroyed the document and later decried it as crud or crap, which that part was in the record, but not the actual destruction, which if there's ever going to be evidence of that there was a lack of probable cause here, of course, not including our report, would go into that. And
Is that part of the history in the Indiana Court of Appeals decision?
It's not mentioned in the decision, Your Honor. The decision Many of the issues had been resolved. Many of the issues had been resolved by the time of the Court of Appeals, so a lot of those types of issues were not actually addressed by the Court of Appeals. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. May it please the Court. In our view,
Could you just tell me your name?
My name is David Steiner.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I know you're on the brief, but sometimes
thank you.
They switch you all.
In our view, this case rises from the very necessary and essential responsibility of a state health agency to survey nursing homes and ensure they are providing care to residents, as required by Medicaid and other laws. And when that is done, sometimes there's going to be some sorts of friction, because after all, the surveyors are going into that facility and they're looking over the shoulders of people as they're working, and they're also looking at records. And their job is to find deficiencies if they exist, not to...
not to create them. There's no law saying they can't be nice about it, though, is there?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And in fact, one of the interesting things about this case is that the president, I believe it was, of Golden Years had actually praised, I think, some of the same surveyors who were involved in this survey and on previous occasions. So that indicates that...
And even the flattery didn't work.
Flattery did not. In this case, Judge, I think the first thing to look at
is... We tickled her funny bone, so you keep going.
Okay. Feels good to laugh.
In this case, you know, I think the main focus is not on this claim that somehow Golden Years was surprised. I don't think there's any real surprise here. Judge Barker, understood that we're really talking about the same evidence on that went to the federal claims that would go to the state law claims.
It is true, though, that you didn't cite the elements of the cause of action for abusive process or malicious prosecution under Indiana law, made no effort to apply those legal standards to the facts. I mean, you had a lot of facts about the state of mind requirement in those claims recited in the briefs in the district court, but didn't take the step that would ordinarily be taken on a substantive motion for summary judgment.
I can't argue with that, Your Honor. That's correct. We did not address those claims by citing the various elements, which are really pretty difficult to meet in order to prove abusive process or malicious prosecution. But we did raise these issues that went to this issue of intent. And Judge Barker, I think, appreciated that. After all, abusive process requires quite a bit, showing of ulterior motive and willful act in the use of process not proper in the regular conduct of the proceedings. And malicious prosecution requires that the defendant instituted or Crosby instituted an action against the plaintiff. The defendant acted maliciously in doing so, and I think that's what Judge Barker saw, just wasn't in this case. The defendant had no probable cause to institute the action, which is just one of the elements. It's something that they want to talk about, but that's just one of the elements. Malice is one of the elements as well, and that's what Judge Barker looked at. And the original action was terminated in the plaintiff's favor. And that didn't actually occur either in the sense that we usually think of these things, because at least one of the contested findings that came out of the May 2000 survey was upheld all the way through the court system. And I believe that there was one or so that wasn't contested of a minor nature from that. And then there were some findings that were upheld from a follow-up survey in July. So in this case, the district court understood that improper motive can be inferred from the circumstances surrounding the action, but she looked at all of the surrounding circumstances. She looked at the evidence. And what she determined in this case is that there was no evidence of malice, because the only things that Golden Years was really talking about was that the survey wasn't as good Because through the normal adjudication process, the dispute resolution process, adjudication process, they were able to get some of these findings modified or set aside. So they were saying the survey wasn't perfect, and we don't contend that it was. But they didn't really win this case in the sense that they won everything. And in fact, if we look at the actual survey, and I think it's interesting, if you look at the actual survey documents, which were attached to the defendant's motion for summary judgment, you see that the surveyors went about this in a very businesslike fashion. They indicated what their observations were personally or of records, and they itemized those things, and then they came to conclusions. And I think it's our expectation that surveyors in these kind of situations are expected to come to conclusions. And we have a whole process available then to the nursing home if they contest those conclusions that were reached by the investigators. But certainly it's in the interest of the residents of the nursing homes for the surveyors to take a pretty hard eye on what they see and not merely accept the determinations made, the claims made by the nursing home.
I've got a legal question about the malicious prosecution standard under Illinois law, I'm sorry, Indiana law. The cases talk about malice, which is, of course, an element of that cause of action, being inferable from a number of things, the total absence of probable cause being one of them, or some sort of personal animosity. But also one of the occurrences that can give rise to an inference of malice, at least the cases seem to speak of this, is the failure to make a reasonable or suitable inquiry into the circumstances. And that sounds to me like a negligence standard, which is inconsistent with the notion of malice in tort law. And I'm trying to reconcile that as I see it running through the Indiana cases. I don't know if you can shed some light on that.
I think if you look at the overall standard for malicious prosecution, we're really talking about the intent. I mean, part of one of the elements is that there be some malice on the part of the person who has commenced the action. And the courts, you know, when they're trying to describe what that is, you know, in a variety of ways, might suggest something that might sound something like negligence, but I don't think that the cases are really suggesting that you would be guilty of malicious prosecution because you didn't know what you were doing, that you just bungled into this kind of thing. I think what we're talking about here when we're talking about malice is some kind of intentional action on the part of whoever it is that's being accused of maliciously, you know, bringing some sort of civil proceeding in this case. And as you indicated previously, Your Honor, this particular survey came about really for a couple of reasons. One was it was a recertification survey. I mean, there was nothing generated in that sense. There was also an annual survey, and then there had apparently been some complaints. But, of course, that's not unusual in a nursing home setting, and we would expect the surveyors to investigate those kind of complaints. But one thing that we pointed out in our brief, now this is not something that Judge Barker addressed, and I think we can stay with what Judge Barker, you know, determined in this case, that there is no evidence of malice, because there certainly isn't. But there's a whole line of case law relating to the claim of malicious prosecution, to our claim of malicious prosecution in Indiana, that indicates that the government and government employees are immune from liability for claims of malicious prosecution.
Right, but immunity is an affirmative defense that you actually have to assert.
That's
so
correct.
Wouldn't you have waived that by failing to assert it?
Well, the only reason I raise that, and I think about that, I think it was the Southern Illinois Riverboat case, and there's some other authorities that were talked about in the briefs. In that case, there was some concern in the Southern Illinois Riverboat case. There was some concern about whether there had been enough notice to the party against whom summary judgment was granted for them to bring forward their evidence. And I think this court actually indicated that the court had concern that the party hadn't really been notified about it, but then it looked at the particular issue and said, well, I think that involved some sort of contract, and there was a provision in the contract that said you can't win. I mean, based on the record, you could tell they couldn't win the case. And so I cite that law just in that sense to say that, you know, so far as malicious prosecution is concerned, it's not likely at all, given that law, that they have any real possibility of winning the claim of malicious prosecution if it went back to the state courts. And those affirmative defenses were asserted and all of those kind of things. So I just raise it in that context. When we look at the case law that has been developed, you know, regarding these things, I think Judge Barker understood what is going on here. She said that there was no evidence of malice or ulterior motive, and certainly there wasn't. As I indicated, what we had was a survey that wasn't even concluded successfully in its entirety in terms of the review process in Golden Year's favor. So you can't say that they prevailed in the case, and they would not be able to win on that malicious prosecution claim on that basis either. But the only things they point to are really a few small anecdotal incidents where there was some friction between the surveyors and the nursing staff. And, you know, those were minor things. Judge Barker points that out. In our view, there really isn't anything in this record that Golden Years points to that in any way suggests they could ever prevail on those claims of malice or ulterior motive. And I don't think anything's been suggested today that's of particular significance. I know that Golden Year says that they didn't have an opportunity at the time to put in everything that they wanted to put in, but as Judge Barker pointed out in her decision, they had every reason to come forward with the evidence. When they were talking about claims of Fourth Amendment claims and 14th Amendment claim of substantive due process, One would expect they would throw in everything but the kitchen sink that might suggest some sort of malice on the part of, or ulterior motive on the part of the surveyors in order to try to prove their claim. They didn't succeed there. Judge Barker recognized they didn't succeed in that regard, and even though it's a bit of a different standard in terms of we're talking about malice, but there is a sense that in order to prevail in the 14th Amendment claim, the action on the part of the defendant needs to be of such a character that it's shocking to the conscience of the court.
Is that the standard in the Indiana courts?
For the malicious? Mm-hmm. No, it isn't, Your Honor. Not,
why are we
it's
talking
malice.
About it? His beef is he didn't get to the Indiana courts. What standard did they use?
They use the standard that it has to be malicious.
Yeah, but the definition of malicious is a little different, as Judge Sykes pointed out.
Different than the 14th Amendment claim. That's correct. Yeah. I think the bottom line, though, in this case was the question, did Judge Barker have the ability to make a decision on the merits of the claim, the state law claims at the time? And the real question is, did Golden Years have their opportunity to bring their evidence in to be considered on that summary judgment?
They brought in the evidence of what they thought was being considered, not what she did ultimately decide.
That's what they say, I understand.
That's what they said.
I still haven't heard, though, any evidence that they could bring in at this point in time. There were depositions taken in this case. That would even be before the summary judgments would have been presented. There was a lot of information that the parties had. There was a lot of information presented. We still don't know what more Golden Years would say about these surveyors in order to prevail and show that they engaged in some kind of malicious conduct.
No answer is send it back down and we'll tell you.
And our answer to that is what Judge Barker said, just as this court has indicated in the number of decisions. If, in fact, it's going to be a waste of time for the state court to have to consider it, the district court might as well decide it. And we urge this court to affirm the decision of the district court in this case.
Your concern for the Indiana state courts is touching.
How much time? We have 5 minutes left.
Your Honor, I will address primarily the state law issues, but I did want to touch back on some of the concerns that have been raised about whether these issues were actually in place. And I want to point out what we heard today for the first time. We heard these parties on the other side who got summary judgment below say, here are the elements of the state law claims, here's why we don't think the facts support them. They didn't do that in the brief. In fact, when they talked to this court in the
what
brief...
What would you put in if you didn't put in?
Your Honor, the biggest difference would be what I said in my opening with in regard to the probable cause. We would have gone through each of the 16 of the 17. We've heard the argument for the very first time today.
Any evidence you would have put in that you didn't put in?
Absolutely. We would have gone through each and every one of the... We discussed why the ALJ and the Indiana process threw out three of those 16 that got thrown out. We would have done all 13. And we were told today that the element of us prevailing below wasn't satisfied, which, of course, was never referenced anywhere until today, which they could have done below. But the violations he cites, too, that we didn't prevail on, we weren't allowed to appeal because under federal regulations you have to have a penalty put against you to be able to appeal to the ALJ. Those were minor violations that carried no penalty. We couldn't appeal. So those aren't at issue in this case. That's the evidence we would have put in. Your Honor,
I'm not quite sure I understood that last argument. You're precluded from appeal because of what?
The violations that were cited that were not taken up on appeal were minor deficiencies that didn't carry a penalty. And under the federal regs, to be able to take the appeal of a deficiency finding, there has to be a penalty imposed because of them. Essentially some kind of consequence of the deficiency, in which this case there wasn't.
I'm having difficulty hearing you.
The deficiencies the appellees are referring to are beyond the 17 I'm talking about. They're minor deficiencies, and we haven't addressed those in this case. They weren't addressed in any of the process because we couldn't take an appeal up. So the way the procedure works, since there's no process initiated against them, we couldn't bring the state law courts against those because there's no violation, so there's no process. Your Honor, what we heard on the merits of the state law claim is essentially a jury argument. We're told that it's simple friction and that.
Well, are you arguing that those minor events would have made a difference?
Which I'm sorry, I'm not sure what I know, but what you mean by minor events, Your Honor?
Well, it's the ones that you maintain you couldn't appeal, the minor deficiencies.
No, because there was no penalty put against us. It's essentially a no harm, no foul situation, which is, of course, why we can't appeal those.
So why is that relevant?
It's not, Your Honor. I'm saying that the appellees are saying it's relevant and that we didn't prevail on our claims because we didn't overturn those on
so
appeal.
So you're just responding to his argument. Yeah, nothing good.
Okay.
Your Honor, the undisputed facts, and they have to be taken in our favor, and I would submit that neither the statement of facts in the appellee's brief nor the statements that were presented to you today give us that deference that we're entitled to because we are on summary judgment. We had a dispute that arose about the application of regulations. In our director of nursing believed that they were being misapplied and they were being misread, and she said so. She defended the care that was given. This erupted into an argument that Judge Barker said there was simply one argument. That's not true. The record shows there were multiple times when these inspectors were shouting at the top of their voice. That's the record, the exact quote, top of their voice, in the middle of the facility in front of patients and guests and accusing our director of nursing and other nurses of misconduct so bad that the undisputed facts of the record, unresponded to by the appellees, that people quit their jobs over this. This is going beyond mere frustration or minor misconduct. People quit their jobs. 10 nurses quit their jobs because they didn't want to be exposed to this. And that's the animosity Judge Barker doesn't even address. Thanks, Your Honor. I appreciate your time. I appreciate the court's time this morning.
Thank you very much to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.